It is Monday, July 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump tells Iran to never threaten the United States. At least two people in Canada are shot dead in Toronto. We look at Canada's gun violence.
Canada does have a gun problem.
And a Michigan candidate seeks to become America's first Muslim American governor. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump has sharply warned Iranian President Hassan Rouhani to never threaten the United States or the Islamic Republic would suffer historical consequences. The president posted his warning on Twitter. Trump appeared to be responding to reports earlier in the day, quoting Rouhani warning Trump, "Don't play with a lion's tail. This would only lead to regret." Rouhani said America must understand well that peace with Iran is the mother of all peace and war with Iran is the mother of all wars. Speaking to a largely Iranian-American audience at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, he described the nearly 40 years of what he called bad fruit emanating from the Islamic Republic of Iran.
40 years of kleptocracy. 40 years of the people's wealth squandered on supporting terrorism. 40 years of ordinary Iranians thrown in jail for peaceful expression of their rights. Why has the regime conducted itself in such an abhorrent way over the past 40 years and subjected its people to these conditions? It's an important question. The answer is at root in the revolutionary nature of the regime itself. The ideologues who forcibly came to power in 1979 and remain in power today are driven by our desire to conform all of Iranian society to the tenets of the Islamic Revolution. The regime is also committed to spreading the revolution to other countries by force, if necessary. The total fulfillment of the revolution at home and abroad is the regime's ultimate goal. It drives their behavior.
Pompeo said Iran is run by a mafia that engages in corrupt activities and has amassed vast illicit wealth at the expense of the Iranian people. He said the U.S., which withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal in May, is targeting Iran's banking and energy sectors with sanctions. Pompeo called on other countries to reduce Iranian oil export to as close to zero as possible by November 4th in an effort to change its behavior. Pompeo said the U.S. will spread the message of solidarity with the Iranian people online and through broadcast to the country. The Foundation for the Defense of Democracy's Benem Ben Talablu attended the speech. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it may put a series of developments in place.
One, greater civic engagement by the Iranian-American community, especially on Iran policy. And two, clear, strong, and direct public diplomacy from the White House to the international community, specifically to the Iranian people, signaling unified support for the Iranian people and pressure against the regime.
The State Department insists the goal is not regime change. What do you think?
I think ultimately that's something that the State Department shouldn't clarify. There may be benefits to ambiguity here. It doesn't help, you know, if you have lots of Iranians on the street and us not talking about them having a better political future. That being said, on the debate over regime change versus behavior change, the administration is clearly looking to impact Iran's foreign and security policy, but also should highlight the plight of the Iranian people.
Does the Trump administration have it right about Iran's malign activity? Some of that activity is actually helpful, for instance, fighting against Islamic State in Iraq.
Yes, the administration is correct to kind of point out Iran's malign activities in Iraq, Syria, Bahrain, Lebanon, elsewhere in the Persian Gulf, and specifically Yemen now. The key is to highlight the activity and then stop the three M's, the men, money, and munitions that Iran is pouring into those conflict zones to destabilize those states.
How important is it that the administration reach out to the Iranian diaspora? What kind of influence do they have?
I think it's critical. It may not be for the purposes of political influence, but it should be done for the purposes of showing a unified body politic, even though the Iranian-American community is by far not a monolith. But the benefit is to show, you know, a united voice in support of the Iranian people, unification and support for pressure against the regime, and to get this very talented community more and more active in civic life in America. And those are all net positives, if you ask me.
Also Sunday, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani cautioned President Trump about pursuing hostile policies against Tehran, saying war with Iran is the mother of all wars. What does he mean?
I think he's looking to successfully use the bully pulpit there. That's not unlike Rouhani in the past. He knows that thus far Iran has been able to deter a conventional war by such rhetoric and by developing an asymmetric security policy. He's only seeking to highlight that right now. It's important political signaling, but no one, again, is calling for a conventional conflict with Iran.
Benem Bentaleblou of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Syria criticizes the evacuation of white helmet rescue workers. President Trump says he gave up nothing to Russian President Vladimir Putin at the recent Helsinki summit. In Somalia, 12 people are killed as al-Shabaab attacks a Somali military base, and a heat wave sends temperatures soaring to a record high in Japan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Getting the flu for most people means 1 to 2 weeks of coughing, runny nose, sore throat, fever, muscle ache, fatigue, and just feeling crummy overall. In more serious cases, it can kill. But how quickly one can recover from the flu may depend on your gender. Past studies have indicated that women tend to be hit harder with the flu and have slower recoveries than men, even when they both have identical influenza virus levels. Conducting experiments on live mice and human cells, a team of scientists from Johns Hopkins University have learned a possible reason for faster male recuperation. That's because men generate more of an important lung-healing protein called amphilregulin than women. They found that the male mice recovered quicker than the females, and male mice who lacked the protein had recovery times similar to the females. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, an unusual pop-up museum in Lisbon, Portugal, promises to keep visits sweet. Police in Toronto, Canada, say a man armed with a handgun shot 14 people late Sunday, killing two of them in an attack that ended with a suspect also dead. Witnesses reported hearing between 20 and 30 gunshots as the shooter fired while walking down a sidewalk in Toronto's Greektown neighborhood. Toronto Mayor John Tory told reporters the city has a gun problem, with the weapons too readily available to too many people. In recent days, police had deployed additional officers in response to a recent wave of shootings. Ian Overton is the executive director of the London-based organization Action on Armed Violence, and he's the author of the book Gun Baby Gun. He tells me how he perceives the recent gun violence in Canada.
From where Canadians stand, their country probably feels quite safe. After all, just across the border in the United States, at least according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there are, between, let's say, 2009 and 2013, there were 56,000 gun homicides in the U.S. And during the same period, there were just under 1,000 firearm homicides in Canada. Now, Canada has roughly something in the region of 31 guns per 100 people. Around 1 in 3 people have a gun in Canada, whereas in the United States, there's just an inordinate amount of guns. There's around one gun per person. I mean, that doesn't mean every single person has a gun. It just means there's around 310 million guns in the States. So from the Canadian perspective, and this is a mantra played out by films and documentaries that sort of stress that, hey, Canada is kind of a haven of safety. And I'm sure that some Canadians are waking up today, scratching their heads, going, you know, this is an American issue and it's penetrated. But actually, from a British perspective, Canada does have a gun problem. So if we included Canada as part of the 31 countries that make up the wider European region, it would actually rank fourth in terms of gun homicide rate. Only France, Germany, and Italy have more gun deaths a year. So Canada does, in a sense, have a gun problem. And I think one of the major reasons it's got a gun problem is because of the Second Amendment, this cultural shift. A lot of guns found in Canada that have been used in violent acts are illegal guns that have come across this very porous and immense border. Now, it was very interesting to read, and this is suppositions, too early to say, but the gun used in the Toronto shooting was a handgun. Now, the vast majority of Canadian gun owners have long guns for hunting, not handguns. Handguns are very, very commonplace in the United States, used for personal protection. In Canada, the culture around guns is more for hunting. But when you look at violence levels, where guns are used in violent acts, we tend to think in mass shootings of things like the AR-15 and the guns used, let's say, in Sandy Hook. But the reality is the vast majority of people killed, both in America and in Canada, are killed by handguns. Handguns are the real threat to public safety. I've got no issue with long guns used for hunting. They're not that used that much in violent murders. They're often used in suicides, but not violent murders. But it's where handguns are used, then you begin to see a proliferation, because they can be easily concealed, ripped out in arguments, and then, you know, people start blasting away. And I hear that this guy shot 20 rounds before he was stopped.
Yeah, you mentioned the porous border. Certainly after 9/11, the general impression was that the border between the U.S. and Canada had tightened considerably. And I know myself, this was many years ago, 20 years ago, but driving across the border, you know, I was asked about, did I have any explosives or weapons in my car? I said, no, I didn't. But of course, there at that time, this was before 9/11, they didn't carry out an inspection either.
Well, this is the thing is, you know, a gun is quite small. A handgun is even smaller in the sense, and you can just, you know, have it in the boot of your car, in the back of your car, and nobody would, unless it was a proper scrutiny, would find it. And the idea that, this is why I think it goes to the very root, is the Second Amendment has become sort of like an absolute cultural policy in the United States. And you see massive numbers of people being killed in Mexico, and you see large numbers of people being killed in Canada, and a lot of them are from U.S. guns. So the number of people being killed in Mexico and Central America, it's around between 60 and 75% of those murders are guns traced back to the United States. And it's no surprise, for instance, that John Bolton, the National Security Advisor in the United States, is also a sitting member of the NRA International Committee, the National Rifle Association Committee. The notion of gun lobby, the enshrinement of the Second Amendment as some sort of holy grail that cannot really ever be challenged, these are rooted deep in the American culture, but they're not rooted in the Canadian culture. But the very proximity is a form of infection. And I think when you look around the world, the Second Amendment has impacted countries far beyond the lands of the United States.
Ian Overton, the executive director of Action on Armed Violence. Scientists in Australia say they've developed the world's first blood test to detect melanoma in its early stages. It's hoped the technique will save hundreds of lives each year by identifying cancer cells before they spread. Australia and New Zealand have the highest rates of skin cancer in the world. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Currently, skin examinations and biopsies are the most effective ways to detect melanoma. A blood test developed by university researchers in Western Australia could pick up the cancer much sooner, increasing a patient's chances of survival. The test recognizes autoantibodies that are part of the body's natural defenses against cancer. In a trial involving about 200 people, the technique detected the early stages of skin cancer in more than 80% of cases. Professor Mel Zeiman is the head of the Edith Cowan University Melanoma Research Group.
We're hoping that it will reduce the number of people that get metastatic disease, because that's where it becomes tricky. If a thin melanoma is identified early and it's removed, you have a 98 to 99% chance of 5 to 10 year survival. So that's what we're hoping to achieve, is that people will feel more comfortable going for skin checks. So it will just up the number of people that are aware and able to get their melanoma identified earlier.
Malignant melanoma is the most serious form of skin cancer. It's mainly caused by exposure to UV radiation. In Australia, about 1,500 people die from the disease each year. More clinical research on the new Australian blood test is planned in an attempt to improve its accuracy to 90%. The technique could be available within 5 years. Researchers have said the test won't pick up other types of skin cancers, such as squamous cell and basal cell carcinoma. Other health experts have said the results of the trial need to be interpreted with caution. They've urged people to keep checking their skin as a way to detect the early signs of skin cancer. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
An unusual pop-up museum in Lisbon is delighting social media-focused visitors with colorful and dreamy displays of giant ice creams, marshmallow pools, and all things sweet. As VOA's Mariama Diallo reports, the museum's founders say it's an attraction that strives to put a smile on the faces of all its visitors.
Among the most visually appealing and appetizing displays at this happiness museum in Portugal are the candy wash bathtub and the splash mallow pool, where visitors can dive into a pool of fake marshmallows. The exhibit is geared toward a young crowd, but parents are welcome to join in the fun.
We are a museum for the new generation, for the generation who lives intensely and wants to share the moments immediately.
It's all about creative photo opportunities, says museum co-creator Carlos Santos, who believes the exhibit will appeal to a social media-focused generation.
The new generation wants to experience, wants to take pictures, and wants to share on the social networks.
The interactive displays include virtual reality games, holograms, and photo competitions. The digital dimension is key to capturing the attention of tech-savvy millennials, says co-founder Hugo Silva.
It's a game we have with the glasses, the virtual reality, and this game you teletransporting to this room, and you can share lots of gummy bears. It's share happiness in disguise, so it's really, really cool.
The exhibition, which runs until August, features a total of 8 thematic and scented rooms, hoping to make mouths water and smiles appear at Lisbon's Sweet Art Museum. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. About 90 Muslim Americans are seeking elective office throughout the United States during midterm elections this year. Many are running as Democrats, hoping to be part of a blue wave that shifts control of the U.S. Congress. As VOA's Kane Faraba reports, among the 13 Muslim candidates running for office in the state of Michigan is a young doctor who's hoping to make history.
When are we going to have leadership that finally stands up and says enough is enough?
He's young, charismatic, and a Rhodes Scholar, who happens to be Muslim.
Who are you here for?
A sharp contrast to some who have held Michigan's highest elected office, an office Abdul El Sayed once thought unattainable.
When I graduated college, Bill Clinton asked me why I was going to med school. And he asked me if I'd ever consider running for office. And at that point, I thought that was off limits for me.
Off limits because of how he had been treated in the past.
I remember I was the captain of my football team, and I was a junior in high school. And the week after 9/11, you know, the games were canceled that week, but the week after we were back on the field. And I remember that football game for the first time, people were calling me names that I'd hear for the rest of my life, right? Raghead, go back to your country, Osama. Funny thing is, my brother's name is Osama. I was like, you think you got the wrong El Sayed.
But he could be the right El Sayed to make history as Michigan's and the nation's first elected Muslim American governor.
That in pluribus unum, that out of many there can be one.
If he can convince enough voters to support him. While his faith and ethnicity have often fueled attacks from his political opponents, El Sayed says Michigan voters have far bigger concerns.
They want to understand what it is that I want to do for them, and they will pay attention to whether or not I have listened first before I start talking about the things that I want to do. And so when people see that, they don't really care that your name's Abdul. They don't care that you pray like this instead of like this.
Times are changing for Arab Americans, says Osama Siblani, publisher of the Arab American News that serves the growing Arab American population in Michigan. But Siblani says the path to the governor's mansion will hinge on El Sayed's overall appeal to Michigan voters.
When John Kennedy ran, you know, everybody thought this is the first Catholic that would he make it to the White House, and he did. When Barack Hussein Obama ran, they said this is the first African-American, would he make it? Are the African-Americans enough voters to elect an African-American? No. But did he make it to the White House? Yes, twice. So is there a chance for a Muslim American to win the governorship? Yes.
El Sayed is among several candidates vying for the Democratic nomination for governor in Michigan's primary election August 7th. He gained recognition as Detroit's top health official and seeks to lead a state still dealing with a water contamination crisis in the city of Flint that began during current Republican Governor Rick Snyder's tenure. Even if Democratic Party voters choose El Sayed for governor in the August primary, he still needs to win enough support to defeat a Republican opponent in the November election in a state that helped Donald Trump win the presidency in 2016. Dean Fairbaugh, VOA News, Traverse City, Michigan.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Mexico is a close and valuable ally of the United States. The two countries not only share a 3,200-kilometer border, but also strong people-to-people ties and cooperation on key issues such as trade, immigration, development, and security. On July 1st, the Mexican people elected a new president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who will begin his term in office December 1st. To reaffirm the strength and importance of ongoing cooperation between the two countries, President Donald Trump sent a high-level delegation to Mexico City, headed by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Mr. Pompeo met with sitting President Peña Nieto, President-elect López Obrador, and high-level officials of both parties to discuss current and future relations and cooperation between the United States and Mexico. We look forward to working with President-elect López Obrador after his inauguration and will continue to work closely with the Peña Nieto administration across our broad range of shared agendas, said Secretary Pompeo. This includes our economic relationship, border and security issues, and the common regional and global priorities that our two countries hold dear. Modernizing the 24-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, is a top priority, said Secretary Pompeo. The United States will continue to work with Mexico and Canada on an updated agreement. We all agree that we want North America to remain the world's most competitive and economically potent region. The United States is also intent on making measurable progress that improves security on both sides of our common border. We'll also keep working to take on the threats of transnational criminal organizations that illegally traffic drugs, weapons, and human beings across our border in both directions, said Secretary Pompeo. Finally, both countries will continue to cooperate on issues regarding regional and global challenges, such as working toward reducing insecurity, violence, and corruption in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, and helping enhance economic opportunity there. Our meetings reaffirm that Mexico and the United States are neighbors, partners, and friends, said Secretary of State Pompeo. There will be difficulties. There will be challenges. Every bilateral relationship has them. But I am confident that if we work with good faith and goodwill, Mexico and the United States can do wonderful things together.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.